Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2024, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial festivals and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Rebecca Lim is an award-winning Australian writer, illustrator, editor, and the author of over 20 books. Her work has been shortlisted for many awards, including the Prime Minister's Literary Awards, New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards, and Queensland Literary Awards. Her CYA novel, Two Sparrows in a Lonely Sky, was shortlisted for the 2024 ARA Historical Novel Prize. It's a great pleasure to welcome Rebecca Lim to Imagining the Past.
Thanks so much, Greg. Really lovely to be here.
So I always kind of start with, what was your first idea you had to become a writer?
I think a lot of writers will probably say this, it's almost like a mental illness. You just sort of feel compelled to write things down on any available piece of paper. So I think when I was a really small kid, probably about 7 years of age, I was really enamored of the Snoopy cartoons, and that really sort of sets my vintage, doesn't it? But I used to sort of see those comic strips and then just sort of write my own stories that sort of came out of those in long form with illustrations, and that's sort of where it happens. I've got boxes and boxes of like half-finished stories and half-finished drawings.
So which character in Snoopy did you relate to the most in Peanuts?
Probably Snoopy and Woodstock, because the humans seem to be, you know, full of foibles and not really understandable at that point. I mean, we'll talk about this probably later, but a lot of the fiction I read as a child sort of didn't really relate to my specific circumstances. So trying to understand, you know, kids from the Midwest in the 1950s, I mean, a lot of the stuff they were doing, it just didn't make any sense at all. But the animals made sense. So fixed on them.
It is kind of true. I remember reading Peanuts and really enjoying it and actually relating to Charlie Brown. But I remember there were so many things that were American specific in it that it was very hard, you know, sitting in Hobart in Tasmania
trying to work out what was happening. Like, you know, the psychiatric booth for 5 cents.
Yeah, exactly.
What is that thing? So, yeah.
So you've had like a very long career, writing career. I'm just wondering if you could give us a quick whirl through some of that, just a quick kind of overview of that.
Sure. So I was enormously burnt out by my day job, and I think I'd been rejected from the Vogel Awards, which was the awards for unpublished writers under 35, for years and years. And so I never thought I'd actually get to be published, but I think in the fifth rejection, I actually got a letter from Alan and Unwin when I was sort of, you know, working until 11 p.m. every night, and they said...
What work were you doing?
I was a commercial lawyer, right. So we just sort of basically sleep in the office sometimes if there were transactions, that kind of awful stuff. So I got this rejection letter, and Alan and Unwin said it was a dreadful manuscript, but the judges, and they don't ordinarily say this, they wanted to let you know that you actually can write. So if you write something better than this, we'll take a look at it. And so that was kind of the impetus for me to actually put my...
How generous of them.
I know, how generous. But, you know, looking back now, it actually was great because it sort of took me off the path of burnout and actually set me going with, like, writing children's books. So that's where I kind of started, because being a pragmatist, I thought, okay, I don't know how to do this, but I'm just going to start with something relatively shorter, relatively less complex, and then take it from there. So I was lucky enough to actually get published while I was taking a hiatus from the law. And I didn't actually return to practicing as a lawyer for about 13 years. But in that time, I managed to get published by people like HarperCollins. So that kind of set me going on my path, I guess.
Did you feel law specifically as a degree? I mean, it obviously leads to a range of jobs, but I've always kind of wished I had done law because it just seems a great overarching kind of education. You know, it teaches you to read. It teaches you to read really specifically and in different kind of modes.
It's a really complex thing. I think when you come from a migrant family, there's this terrible thing hanging over your head where you have to do something useful and not something that you actually want to do. So I think when I was at school, I mean, I did all the subjects and all the sciences and all that kind of thing to do medicine because that's what my parents were really pushing for. But I knew deep down I really wanted to be a writer. I didn't know how to do that. And I knew that if you're a lawyer, you can at least, you know, learn how to write on deadline, learn how to sort of assimilate lots of information really quickly, learn how to write to specific audiences. So, you know, I often write for like boards, but I also write for like, you know, people who don't have any background in law. So you've got to deal with, you know, people with no idea about the complexity, but get the complex ideas across in a way that they can understand. So to my parents' absolute horror, and I think they were just pressuring me up until the point where I could actually make the change and go to a different course, I just said, I'm going to do law because I want to understand how Australia works. Like in the sense that a lot of migrants and refugees, they come here and they think, I don't understand any of the institutions. I don't get why, you know, things work this way. For me, I think doing law sort of helped me at least navigate this system, like try and understand it a little bit better, but also get the skills necessary to actually even tackle getting published.
I wanted to discuss your, you know, one of a better word, migrant experience a bit later, but maybe you could just give us a little bit of an idea about your family's history here.
Sure. So I am a first generation migrant because I came as a kid, but my dad actually was a Colombo plant scholar. So he went from Singapore and a purely Chinese-speaking school to university at the University of Adelaide in sort of the late 60s, I think. So he did a medical degree there. And I think in his year, he was one of only three Chinese students. So that was a huge eye-opener for him. So he'd gone from purely speaking Chinese dialects to, you know, studying in English and dealing with people in English. And something must have sort of caught his imagination while he was here because he went back to Singapore and, he worked there in the system for a long time so he could actually, pay off his debts, look after people in Singapore. But I think he always wanted to come back here because he loved the lifestyle. He also thought it would be easier for us as children, you know, if he raised a family to live in Australia rather than in Singapore. And you probably have seen, you know, recently Singapore is like a really high pressure environment now. It's quite hard on its kids. So I think he kind of thought maybe they'll have a better life if we actually settle down here. So he came back after a few years of working in Singapore to rural Queensland in the 1970s. So you can imagine that was still a big shock. I think, you know, our family and one other lady who was married to a Caucasian Australian man, we were the only Asians in Warwick at that point. And so my mum was like learning to cook from that one Asian lady in country Queensland because she didn't have any resources or networks there. And he worked at the Warwick Base Hospital. So in a sense, we were speaking lots of Chinese dialects in the home, but then, you know, having to navigate, I guess, rural Queensland. And then after that, we moved down to Melbourne and sort of navigating Melbourne in the 1970s, speaking Chinese at home, but then dealing with people in English in the outside world. So that's kind of my backstory, I guess.
So what was the first idea you had for Two Sparrows in a Lonely Sky? Where did this come from?
So I was really lucky because my background obviously is first generation migrants, but my husband's family, they've been here for three generations. And so his grandfather, who basically kicked off the big migration journey for them, he came in the very late 40s to early 50s to Australia. So there's a lot of papers on him in the National Archives. So family members basically handed me this treasure trove of documents. You know, it's got really familiar names in it. Harold Holt was the immigration minister at the time. Alexander Downer's dad was in the papers. Arthur Caldwell wrote a letter of recommendation for, you know, our grandfather. So there was all this stuff that kind of kicked off the thinking of, you know, if Chinese people weren't actually welcome in Australia at that time because of the laws and the White Australia policy, how did we actually get here? And so that kind of set off thinking about how do I explain to kids what asylum seeking is? How do I explain to them what migration is? How do I discuss mid-20th century Australia versus China in a way that makes sense for children and isn't too complicated? And like, you know, opens up that whole discussion because our history lessons, I mean, I remember from the 70s and 80s, anyone who wasn't British, their migration story was just never spoken about. So we'd, you know, learn about the Eureka Stockade, we'd learn about Federation, we'd learn about the Gold Rush, all essentially anti-Asian things. And you'd learn about Gallipoli, but there were apparently no soldiers there who were not white, but there were, you know, in real life, there actually was Asian Australian soldiers, there were First Nation soldiers, people from different backgrounds. So we got this history that was kind of, I guess, whitewashed. And so like, I wanted to like, I mean, the fact that I'm still having to open up this kind of discussion in the 2020s, right? It's like, how did other Australians get here? And so I'm just trying to write a story for kids, which is from a non-British immigrant background, because our canon is still very much dominated by those books.
My grandparents, my mother's parents, came kind of around the First World War and between the wars from Manchester. But my father's parents came from Fife in Scotland in the 1820s. But my grandparents still had these very heavy accents, and there was always this very similar thing that I think I've encountered with other migrant groups of this referring back to the mother country, whether it was Italy or China or whatever.
Lebanon or wherever.
So there was this additional heavy presence, the UK and of Britain in our household that I don't feel like my other friends had. And it did influence me. It's much more subtle than, you know, the things that you encountered, but I just kind of feel like it's too easy to dismiss the British experience as well, which is a migration experience as well.
Yeah, no, and I'm not dismissing it at all, but I think, you know, obviously we've started to open up the migration story for British immigrants. If you think about, you know, oranges aren't the only fruit and all that kind of stuff, like there are kids who've, maybe I've mixed up the book, I'm sorry, I think I've just mentioned a Jeanette Winterson novel.
Yeah, no, that's Jeanette Winterson.
You know, the Australian novel where you talk about the children coming out post-war or during the war, were just sent out here and adopted by people and they had no idea what was happening to them. So I think, you know, a lot of the richness of the British immigration experience is starting to be opened up as well. But I think a lot of our history is based on, you know, First Fleet, convicts, you know, that kind of, and that's the problem that migrant authors often face as well. English people are taken as one blob with no nuance. And, you know, Lebanese people are taken as one blob with no nuance, you know, Middle Eastern people. And it's like there are so many variations between people's stories that you can't just go, well, that was the British migration experience. That was the Chinese migration experience. So this particular story is really about how would I have navigated the White Australia policy as an asylum seeker in the 50s if, one, China didn't want me to leave the country, and, two, Australia didn't want me to come.
Yeah, so there are additional hurdles. I just think the migration experience is such a, any migration experience is such a difficult thing.
Yeah, you know, traumatic thing.
Anyone to leave their country, you know, when I've been in a position of wanting or having the possibility to leave Australia, I balked at it. You know, I just couldn't actually come at it because it is such
an enormous thing. It's a huge
deal. It's huge. You know, and I think that's so readily forgotten across the board, really, just what people do.
And
No, you go.
I was just going to say, just the interesting thing about your grandparents' experience and the fact that, you know, your home felt very Scottish or very English still, I think is because, you know, when they do migrate here, and it is such a traumatic thing, they cling on to their customs and they cling on to their traditions at the point where it's almost frozen, at the point where they come. And so it never changes. You know, at Christmas we always eat this or, you know, whatever. And like a lot of the older migrants, they just go, this is how we've always done it. And we're just going to wing it because that's safe and it fits right.
Yeah.
And so that's what you experienced in the home.
Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, there were things like letters would come from the UK and they would have, you know, bad news as people were dying and, you know, getting old and dying and things. And like I said, there was just this presence in the house that I don't think I acknowledged or recognized till quite recently, really. Your title, The Two Sparrow Hawks and a Lonely Sky, is a lovely, lovely image. I'm just wondering how you arrived at it and what's the metaphor around the sparrow hawks?
Sparrow hawks are kind of like a fairly tough, common native bird to southern China. And so what I wanted to try and do with the title is take something that's very small, possibly has no agency, not much strength, and, you know, plop it into like a wider context. So I've taken something from a very local perspective and tried to give it a global perspective. So how well would that very tough native common bird survive in a broader environment? So that's kind of where the title came from.
So your research was obviously quite vast and I'm sure took many forms, but and you also, there's some very specific details you've got in there, like when the bamboo plants flowered. I thought that was, you know, a magic kind of observation. So how did your research go? You've mentioned you had some family documents to start with. Where did you go from there?
It was like, you should see my electronic file for this book. It's absolutely enormous. It's got, you know, YouTube videos from 1950s marketplaces in China, through to, I think, Hong Kong and, you know, police officers standing on cement blocks and directing traffic. So it's all very, that gave me the detail and the richness and the colour. Starting with the Australian legal documents, which are extremely of the era, full of portentous language, obviously tracing all of these immigration officers chasing this poor man through different Australian cities because they wanted to deport him for not meeting his visa conditions. And his sole visa condition, I think, was you're only allowed to haul bananas in the markets in Sydney. If you do anything else, we're going to send you out of the country. So sort of beginning with a modern slavery type narrative, I then went back and looked at, well, why did he come to Australia in the first place? Obviously, I've transplanted the timing a little bit because I think when Granddad got here, it was the start of the Communist Party, so very late 40s. And because he was an intelligence officer during the war, I think for the Taiwanese leaning side rather than the Communist Party side, he was actually in danger. So I kind of took those family stories about if I was on the losing side in the Chinese Communist War, what would I have to do to get to safety? How would I get there? And so there's a very famous person in Australian history called William Liu. He was based in Sydney and he wrote letter after letter to the government, begging for other Asian Australians to be able to remain in Australia. And he lived till he was about 96. So there's a vast archive on him. And he actually helped our grandfather get to this country because he, like the character in the story who saved from drowning, he actually was saved from drowning by a family member in a village in China because William Liu was Eurasian. He was half Asian and half white. So, when he was sent back to China to actually, learn how to speak Chinese, people used to call him a foreign devil and try to kill him. Like they'd throw him in a cage and then throw him in the well and then hopefully, you know, someone would come along and fuck him out of that. So all of these like family stories and family papers kicked off the story. But then I shifted the narrative forward slightly so that instead of being, you know, at the start of the Communist Party's, you know, rise to power in China, it'd be in one of their programs, like during one of their programs. So the one I chose was the Great Leap Forward. And people won't necessarily know about this, but the Great Leap Forward caused about 45 million deaths in China. So, you know, because of these increasingly slightly insane policies, farmers were basically unable to, you know, live off the stuff that they were growing. They'd be selling it off overseas or they'd be giving it to people in the city to live on because everything was collectivizing. So I thought if I had the family sort of desperately trying to survive something like that and having the father away from the family, how would these two children with absolutely no power and no authority get from a village that's starving to death into modern Australia? So that was kind of, you know, all of those kinds of things kind of went into the story. How do we make a comment on, you know, Australia in the 20th century? How do we make a comment on China in the 20th century? And how do we use all of the forces that force people to leave home in a narrative for children? So there's all that kind of stuff happening and hopefully it's not too heavy-handed. It's kind of what I was thinking about.
Yeah. You mentioned Yun's northern language, which I'm going to destroy the pronunciation of, Pong What is it?
Putonghua. Oh. So that's just Mandarin. I mean,
it is Mandarin, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Mandarin. So I think Putonghua is like, you know, the Chinese Communist Party's name for Mandarin because they want that to be the common language. So Putong is like ordinary and Hua is speech. So ordinary speech. So she comes down from, I think I had her sort of coming from somewhere like above Shanghai, and she already speaks Mandarin. And so she's come to this village in the south as a wife, and they all speak a different language. And the language I had in mind was Toisan, which is closer to Cantonese. So this is the thing I also wanted to tell kids. Not all Chinese people are exactly alike because the country is vast. There's about 165 ethnic, you know, groups. So what I needed to do to tell kids was, you know, all Chinese people aren't the same because, you know, the mother came from somewhere else, the father came from somewhere else, and the kids are navigating more than one language. So they've got the mother's language and they've got the father's language, and then they have to learn English. So it's really just trying to tell kids not everyone has the same lived experience as you. And like, you know, you've got to make allowances for people in your class who maybe don't speak English because they've got 50 other things happening in the background.
Just as an aside, where does the word Mandarin come from? I've always kind of wondered.
I know
that.
It's bizarre. I think, I mean, I read around about this, but it's because, you know, the English explorers who first went to the Chinese ports would call officials Mandarins, the high Mandarins of the port. And so I think whatever language they spoke, they just use that word of describing the officials to describe the language. So that's where the English, you know, name for it came from. But it's a bit odd because like in Chinese, we don't call it Mandarin. We just call it either Putonghua or Hanyi or, you know, something. We talk about the name of the language rather than something that an English person has ascribed to the language.
So what were your thoughts around using the Mandarin language or Chinese language? Because you've translated some words, not translated, but represented some words with English or Latin characters. I'm just kind of wondering around your thoughts around that when you were developing the text.
I've done this in a few other books of mine. So I often will just drop other languages in, even if it's Latin or German or something else into the story, because, you know, my guiding principle when I write for kids is I want to represent the world that we actually live in. So people will have mental illnesses, they'll speak other languages, they may be poor, they may be rich, you know, all sorts of things. So beyond this novel, I've done it in the past where I try to naturalistically introduce other languages into the text without alienating the reader. So I'll put context around, if someone says something in a different language, I'll try to put context around it and explain it in the next bit of narrative that comes through. So I won't necessarily go, he said this was my house, and then I'll say that exactly the same in Chinese. I'll try to like say the Chinese words, but then give, you know, context following that explains exactly what that character just said in a different language. And I think that's what happens in real life as well. Like you have to draw from context. If you hear someone on the tram speaking in Greek, for example, you're trying to work out, is that Greek and what are they talking about? So that's how I try and write novels as well. Like just naturalistically introduce like other languages and other sort of concepts around, you know, being human.
Yeah, I thought you did a great job of it because it wasn't some other books I've read that have done similar things have been a little bit too heavy-handed with it, I think. And it just, you know, you're reading a book, you're time poor, you need
yeah,
to
like you don't
want to
be chucked
to read
out of the story because someone's yeah. trying to explain to you the grammatical, you know, connotations.
Yeah. So I thought you did it really well. The other thing I really enjoyed was the extract from the letter from Bob Chen in the beginning, which is graphically represented to A.G. Turner. Is that real? Did you find that letter in the archive?
But, like I have this, I mean, that's the thing. In the papers, there are all sorts of appalling letters in there, you know, about people begging other people not to deport, you know, third parties and stuff. So, you know, I'm looking at the letter right now. It's next to me. And this is to Mr. A.R. Peters, Acting Secretary, Department of Immigration. So this is from the late 40s. Dear Mr. Peters, you know, the name of my granddad. I thank you for your letter of 26th Ultimo, re my above-mentioned nephew coming to Australia. So there's actual, like, I guess, real sources for the letter that I wrote, but obviously I had to take a very convoluted early 20th century language and dumb it down or, you know, make it simpler for a younger audience. So I've got heaps and heaps of official papers written by, and I would say they were called Mandarins of the Department of Immigration, where they're chasing around my granddad and trying to get him out of the country because he wants to run a restaurant selling bananas. So there's, I've got lots of, I guess, more complex sources for the stuff that I wrote about, but I had to just make it understandable enough for kids and also to kick off the action for the rest of the story. It's kind of like a, you know, a prologue or a prompt.
Yeah, but I think on top of that, just the way it's represented in the text as a letter that's been found in an archive, I kind of thought that was a really great, you know, it was almost like a training exercise in historical fiction for a younger person because, you know, I remember when I first started researching characters, you know, real people and finding this kind of evidence that they did actually exist in the archive was really thrilling. So I can imagine there's an authenticity that this brings to historical fiction of having it represented like this, I think.
And that's the thing as well. Like you do actually see names of real people like Arthur Caldwell. So it's like, how do I talk about the feeling of the time without necessarily defaming anyone or mentioning anyone who's real? So I think in the story, I do actually name an actual Australian Trade Commissioner, and I put that in my acknowledgements because he was the person who was running the Hong Kong office at the time. And obviously, as a fictional device, I've inserted this fictional acting Trade Commissioner into his office. So I've kind of had to reference him in the story as being the real person in charge, but he's away for the weekend, so this guy's doing it instead. So that's the kind of thing, like it's a real balance between how do I actually use real people in a historical fiction narrative without, you know, necessarily making any, I mean, we talked about this separately, I think, in a different conversation, like how do you humanize someone like a Hitler or someone like a Goebbels or someone like, you know, Harold Holt without going too far because we don't know what they were like. We can't necessarily speak for them, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a delicate balancing exercise, especially for kids, I think.
One thing, I mean, I don't read CYA a lot. I think one thing that this book brought up for me, which I think you did really well, but you know, there's perhaps in representing these situations, these awful situations, there's a kind of need to simplify the complexity of the situation. So I'm just, you know, in your book, you know, I think that that Pei and Fu's situation, they were, there was an ease of their passage, that there wasn't a lot of human trouble in their passage.
It was
more the weather.
Book, yeah. Yeah. In another book, you would draw that out. You know, they missed their boat or, you know, somebody refused to help them or whatever. But I think...
Oh, someone assaulted them.
You know, yeah, someone, yeah, exactly. People were unkind to them, that kind of thing. But you just... I think for a children's novel, there's pretty so much awful stuff happening. You know, people being taken out into a field and being shot, people dying of starvation that... You know, if you loaded in all this extra stuff, it'd be like an 800-page novel in that case because, you know, maybe someone was really rude to them, maybe someone slapped them in the face, you know, all that kind of stuff would have happened in real life. But I think you're already sort of funneling enough really bad stuff, you know, like really difficult adult concepts into a kid's head. I don't think they need to see all that other ugliness, if that makes sense, because there's already so much ugliness in there.
Yeah, I just... feel like it's in danger of kind of sanitizing the story to the point where, you know, we're coming to something akin to Schindler's List, you know, the film of Schindler's Ark, where the suffering is kind of transformed into something that's just not too offensive, you know.
Yeah, so, and is easily palatable. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, and I just kind of wonder about whether this is the stuff of CYA, you know, or do these texts for younger people kind of stand almost as a taster, you know, like a TikTok device or a trailer for a film for what they will discover later in life in more complex adult books.
I think so. I mean, possibly because, I mean, when I started writing for young adults, for example, we're talking kids 14 plus, the thing that readers don't understand when they pick up a book is that the publisher has been there already giving the author advice about how far can I actually push this, for example. So for one of my earlier novels, which was for older teens, they said, no kissing, no hand-holding, no sex scenes, keep it clean, right? And so the novel before this one, Tiger Daughter, which I wrote, there was a suicide in it. And so the publisher said, for this age group, you cannot show the body. And I was like fighting them on this. I was going, you need to see the body. And they're like, no. Don't show the body. They can't handle it. And so this is for this Two Sparrowhawks in a Lonely Sky is for a younger age group even than that one. And so the balance here was, you know, how much do I show of the guy being shot? How much do I show of them narrowly missing out on, you know, catching a boat to Hong Kong? How much do I show of people being rude to a child because she's Chinese and she's from the Stevie Ridge class? There's all that kind of delicate negotiation that goes on with your publisher before the thing even hits the shelves, where they're going, it can be horrible, but not too horrible, because the audience simply cannot handle it. And so, I mean, for you, probably this is way too easy a text to read, and it probably does sanitize, you know, the cannibalism that happened, the terrible deaths that happened in the Great Leap Forward. But I think children are already being bombarded with, wow, Australia is made up of, you know, people from different places. It's been here a lot longer than I've been here. What would have happened to, like, have those people come to this country? What laws did we have in place? What laws did they have in place? There's a lot of stuff going on already. And so I think it's not necessarily that I'm sanitizing it. I think I could overwhelm them with the detail, but it does no service to the narrative. And it probably doesn't help me get across the points that I want to get across, which is, kids, you've got to have empathy. Not everyone's like you. Kids, this country was built by people from different backgrounds, not just by, you know, English people. All that kind of stuff is already so densely packed in there that if I sort of went into, you know, the fact that the children may have had sores under their clothing, or everyone smelled to high heaven because they never had baths, all that kind of stuff doesn't sort of, you know, I guess, support the principles or the big ideas that I'm trying to get across. It just kind of weighs down the narrative and makes it too boggy and too slow and too big and too baggy.
Did you ever get to a point when you were writing it of thinking, maybe I should make this an adult book?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I have a very long history as a children's author. And ironically, like, while I was writing this, I had an adult crime novel out on, you know, submission with people, and that's actually been accepted for publication now. And so it's really different writing for adults than it is for kids, because as we were talking about before, you can swear, you can go to town, you can talk about anything with an adult novel, but with a children's novel, it's almost like, how much can I cram into your head in words that you'll understand without overwhelming you? So I did kind of think about writing it as an adult novel, but I think the simplicity of this is, it's almost like a parable. How do I explain the history of this nation in a way that's relatively easy to understand, but also get my ideas across that, you know, this nation wasn't necessarily built on the most, you know, lovely ideology. There were people here before. People are constantly trying to come here. Why are they trying to come here? So I think there's a lot of novels for adults already which talk about how bad things like the Great Leap Forward were. You know, you've got Wild Swans, you've got, you know, the Mouth Last Dancer, all that kind of stuff, which talks about, you know, really awful personal stories from, you know, the time of like the big communist programs. But I don't think there's anything like that for kids. And so this is almost like, I'm trying to tell you kids that life isn't always rosy. And there's like many different reasons for why things are the way they are. And so I think when you write for children, you've got a real responsibility to introduce them to things in a safe way, which you don't as an adult. So I think, you know, like I didn't have a proven background as an adult author. I just felt like I could probably do more good talking about history to children in this way than I could, you know, entering a market that's full of basically awful personal, you know, stories.
I enjoyed in the novel the discussion around the Chinese restaurant in Australia. I remember being taken to by another family to a Chinese restaurant in Hobart, which must have been in the late 60s, I think. That family was much more sophisticated than my family. But I remember being eating steak and chips in this Chinese restaurant and having this kind of crisis of, you know,
yeah, you were
why,
like, well,
why am I here
eating this place? I know the thing that you can't see from the novel is there's a little excerpt from a menu in there. And actually, amongst that trove of papers in the National Archives, there was a menu from the time of my grandfather being chased around by immigration officials, which was his first restaurant in Goulburn in New South Wales. And so the menu is that sort of mix of steak and eggs, and, you know, oyster omelette, and just like really bizarrely juxtaposed together in this printed menu from a country town, you know, Chinese restaurant. So that's why I kind of like extracted a bit out of that menu to demonstrate what the kind of menu you saw as a child would have been like at the time. So that's kind of why I did that. Like, there's a lot of visual stuff in there where I'm trying to tell kids, you know, you might not have seen this before in Australian history, but it was there.
That's
why I've done that.
But I think that's a really, you know, broad Australian story of how different ethnic groups have had to torture their cuisine to kind of make it palatable, you know. And I remember too when I first moved to Sydney and going to Cabramatta and seeing this huge, you know, Vietnamese enclave, and just enjoying the food that was there, but then also kind of having this realization, well, I wonder how authentic this food is.
I think it's getting more authentic these days.
I think so now.
Now, whereas in the past, you know, curried egg was probably as exotic as anyone. So that's why, like, getting a whole menu full of, you know, honey sesame prawns or whatever, that would have spun people's minds out in the 50s. But yeah,
I wonder too. There was talk, and there was a book that came out about it a long while ago now. But I mean, there was talk, you know, that Chinese food in Australia was actually better than it was in China during the 60s and 70s because of the availability of better ingredients here. And does that kind of ring true?
That probably would have rung true because if you think about it, the 60s was the Cultural Revolution in China. I think probably most people weren't eating them and running for their lives probably. So I think, yeah, it's that whole thing we talked about before of where you come over and your traditions are crystallized. And you come with all the knowledge that you think you'll ever need. And so, you know, the people running the restaurants at that time are probably doing high Cantonese cuisine or whatever they need from China and using the freshest Australian produce to do it. So probably, yeah, the food probably was much better.
Wow. That's a great idea, isn't it? I just wondering if you could give us a quick description about how you've used point of view in your novel, because you did move around quite a bit in that. So just... I'm always interested in the decisions you made around point of view and how you played that out in the novel.
Sure. I mean, that letter that you were talking about, the immigration letter, obviously it's written by one, you know, man to another man, and so that's in the first person. And that kind of sets off the whole journey. And then I think for this novel, I mean, I usually write in first person, I think, when I'm writing for an older audience, because young adults seem to respond to the I perspective a lot better. But for this one, because I wanted to try and show things that were happening all over the chessboard, I guess. You know, this is what's happening in China, this is what's happening in Hong Kong, this is what's happening on the boat. I generally used a third person, but there's a little bit of head hopping. You know, there's head hopping between the Jewish woman on the boat who teaches Hey English. There's, you know, head hopping between the acting trade commissioner, Kit Stevenson, and the kids. So it's trying to, I guess, give children a sort of omnipresent view of this world that the two children are running through. They're running through essentially feudal China into Hong Kong, which is vastly more cosmopolitan, where they first see electricity for the first time. And they're dealing with, I guess, Western people. They've never had to speak to a Western person before, even though he can speak English. He's obviously coming out of a Western office environment. So they're like, I've never seen this before. A man with a typewriter, for example. And then I'm getting them onto a boat with other steerage passengers who are stuck below deck. Everyone's from different parts of China, so they're sort of hearing all sorts of dialects, all sorts of people from different backgrounds, and then putting them on the deck of the boat where they're mingling with the tourist class and the first class passengers, and how, you know, the officials on the boat are trying to keep the nice people away from the not so nice people.
Mm. Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot, the bringing in the Polish Jewish woman. Is it Eva?
Eva, that's right.
Because I knew a lot of Russian Jews had come through Shanghai, and a lot had come to Australia, but I hadn't thought about Polish people. Just give us a little bit of an idea how you arrived at that as well. I just thought that was a really interesting turn in the novel.
That's also like me trying to say to kids, you know, not only did non-British people come to Australia in the form of people like Eva. So, you know, they called them the Bolts, because they looked white, but they weren't really the same as English people, right? I wanted to show that there were migrants like them as well as migrants like Hay and Fu and other people. So with her, I think I was reading a lot of the Holocaust archives where the Polish Jews from one of the ghettos came through Japan and ended up in Shanghai. So I think the Russian people possibly came a different way. But there was a whole enclave of Polish Jewish people that ended up in Shanghai as well. And, you know, waves of them would go to America or to Australia or to other places. And I just wanted to have someone who, I guess, I mean, when you construct a story, you need devices. I needed someone who could speak Chinese, but could also teach Hey English, for example. So two was ideal because I could make a comment on how, I guess, Polish Jewish people had been treated during the war by their own, you know, country folk, but also talk about how cosmopolitan China was at the time because it had different people also from a non-Chinese background living there, and then show that, you know, the migration journeys of people from vastly different places can all funnel into the same place at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah. I worked with a Russian woman who I think was born in Shanghai, but she always used to say, "I'm from Shanghai," but when it was something,
yeah,
you'd always qualify it with.
I know, but then she probably, that poor woman, when she said that, probably got the follow-up question, "No, but where are you really from?" Which I've, you know, many times during my life, "No, but where are you from?" You can't just say, "I was born here," or I lived here," or "I've been in Australia for 50 years," right? They just want to know what your actual background is.
Yeah, but it's an interesting question, don't you think? I mean,
yeah, it's such a nuanced question. Like, you know, when you ask someone that, it just throws up the, you know, "And then I had a Nigerian uncle, and then I had," it's not a simple thing.
No, it's not a simple thing, but that's what's so intriguing about it. For myself, it's always something I'm interested in. So you've kind of talked about this a little bit, but has it been hard to negotiate your career over so many publishers?
It has a bit. I mean, I think if you don't stay so-called loyal to one publisher for your entire publishing career, you tend to get less marketing and other support because they don't see you as being, you know, one of their stable. You just kind of flit about from place to place. And so if they over-market your title with them, then it might be helping out your titles with somebody else. So unfortunately for me, like, I go to publishers who will publish my work because I think as bizarre as some of the things I've written is, I've managed to find a home for most of it. And so for me, it's more important to get the work out there than to look like I'm, you know, a stable mate of a particular publisher, because I just need to get the work published because there's often important things or things that I think are important that I want to say or I want to tell kids about. So that's kind of why. And, you know, for example, the adult novel that I'm having published with the Firm Press, hopefully next year, it's got a serial pedophile in it. And so obviously my children's publishing houses kind of looked at the manuscript with trepidation because they're like, "But you write for kids, so how can you have a pedophile in your adult novel?" So, I mean, this is why I've had to separate out, you know, my sci-fi goes to this person, or my fantasy novels go to this person, or my migrant stories go to this person, because often they'll say, "But you've got a brand with us and it doesn't fit the brand. Like, where are we going to jam a book about, you know, someone catching a pedophile in with your kids' books," right? So for me, like, it's more important for me to get the work published with a good publisher than it is to stay with one publisher, as unfortunate as it is for me in terms of the career thing. I mean, I think getting the work out there is more important.
So what does Two Sparrows in a Lonely Sky tell us about the world today?
It's really interesting because, like, when I was researching it all and, you know, the dictation test and all the stuff that apparently we don't have anymore, we still have that stuff. You know, we've got other ways of, you know, like, filtering out people that this nation doesn't necessarily want to have here. So it just showed me that history is enormously cyclical and that, you know, lots of the stuff that we've seen in the past and, you know, things where we've said never again will we ever do anything that bad, right? It comes up again and again because always we end up, because of human nature possibly, or I don't know, protectionism, we will end up doing this bad stuff again in some other form, but it's recognized. So I think it's just, I mean, it's a story possibly of, you know, narrow interest to people set in mid-20th century Australia and China. Who would want to read about that, right? But it's funny because when you read it, you think, hey, that's happening right now with all of our offshore detention systems and the fact that the voice referendum didn't get up and all this kind of stuff. All of the things that we never resolved in 20th century history are coming true again in, you know, 21st century history. So it kind of shows you that humans have a lot to learn still. Like, we haven't maybe evolved as far as we think we have.
So just to finish up today, what are you working on now?
At the moment, I have another strange sort of paranormal thing on the go with another author. So we're sort of co-writing that one, and that's sitting with a publisher at the moment. And I'm editing the revenge fantasy against a serial pedophile thing with the firm at the moment. So bits and pieces. I'm also sort of working on an academic thesis that's sort of covering similar ground to Two Sparrowhawks, you know, dealing with how the White Australia policy impacted our published canon, you know, during the years in which it was in place. So I'm actually analysing who was writing books at the time, what was their output, you know, where did they come from, and how did that, I guess, make invisible all of the other sort of potential Australian creators that were out there at the same time.
Anyway, look, I've really enjoyed our conversation today. That's lovely. So good luck with everything in the future, and well done in being shortlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize.
Thank you. That was such a great honour. It was amazing.
Okay, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Greg. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. And it's festival year, History Unbound, to be held at Parramatta Town Hall on the 1st and 2nd of November 2025. Both in-person and online tickets are available. Please visit our website, www.hnsa.org.au, register for our newsletter, and join our social media groups to be up to date. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening, and keep imagining the past. Imagining the Past is commercial free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Thank you.